Welcome to the Positively Past, Positively Present podcast. My name is Ketlow, and I'm a researcher practitioner in the field of arts and health, and I've been collaborating with Positively UK since 2016. This series of podcasts came about through a project we've been doing looking at Positively Women's Archive, where we've been looking at the power of the archive to allow us to look back in order to be able to move forward. On the podcast each week, we'll speak with different guests who have been connected with Positively UK, both past and present. We explore different themes relating to the experience of women living with HIV. All of these have been recorded online as we wanted to include a wide range of voices, both safely and across borders. The nature of these conversations cover topics that some listeners might find difficult. So we invite you to please consult the episode's show notes before listening to the podcast. And finally, huge thanks to colleagues both at Positively UK and the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama who've helped bring these podcasts together. We hope you find these discussions illuminating and insightful. Welcome to the Positively Women Past and Present podcast. I'm Kat Lowe, and today I'm joined by Alice Wellborn. Alice is an activist, researcher, and participatory trainer in the field of HIV. In 1993, Alice started developing the Stepping Stones training program focusing on gender, HIV, communication, and relationship skills. She is the founding director of the Salamander Trust and a former chair of the ICW, the International Community of Women Living with HIV and AIDS. In today's episode, we are continuing our investigation into the role that gender plays in individuals' health outcomes, with specific reference to HIV. So welcome, Alice. Delighted to have you on the podcast. Where are you speaking to us from today?
Thank you very much, Kat. It's an honour to be welcomed, to be invited to take part. I'm speaking from the wilds of Dartmoor in the southwest of the UK. For a change, the sun is shining brilliantly today. It's not very usual, but it is today. So that's a very good omen for us.
Oh, divine. So Alice, if you don't mind, we'll just begin thinking about Positively Women and what is your connection with the organisation?
So I first came across Positively Women when I was diagnosed with HIV on the 21st of June 1992, when I was expecting a baby and full of the joys and hopes of that. My GP had suggested that I go through a few routine pregnancy tests, and she also suggested that I might have an HIV test in there for good measure. And I said, yes, sure, of course, no problem, fully imagining that everything would come back fine. But on that date, I was told that I have HIV. And she was amazing. My partner then, who's now my husband, my long-term husband, is amazing. And also my consultant was amazing. And I had incredible care and support. I had to go through a medical termination, which was something I absolutely didn't want. But in those days, it was what was recommended. But despite all of going through that with incredible care and support from my healthcare providers and my partner, there was still something somehow extra that I needed. So I phoned up Positively Women, I think maybe a month or two after all of this had happened. And I remember standing in my house in London where I lived at the time, very nervously phoning up this number and having a bright, breezy voice on the other end, a lovely Irish woman, and saying, I've got HIV. And she was saying, oh, yes, I've got it too. What would you like to talk about? How can we help you? And the very fact that she said, I've got it too, and sounded bright and cheerful and warm and welcoming, was in itself just a revelation to me. And I burst into floods of tears straight away, but she was there already. And that was just incredible. So that was my first connection with them. And then shortly after that, she invited me, in fact, to go to a women's group that they were running at the original premises in Islington. And I remember walking down Regent Street, I think it was, that afternoon, And even though I had my loving husband, I had older children whom I loved dearly, I still thought that I had such a short time to live anyway, and that I had let everybody down. Such is the depth of self-stigma which HIV generates in so many people, sadly, to begin with, that I seriously contemplated throwing myself under the next bus that came along. But I thought, no, well, you know, I better not. And that was the first time ever that I had considered such a thing. So I went along to the meeting that evening, and that meeting was just incredible because there was a fabulous lady there who has sadly died, but she told us all about how she'd been diagnosed in prison through the trap, the little trap in the door of her prison cell. And she was in there on a drugs charge. And this prison warder had just opened the trap and said, oh, by the way, you've got HIV, and slapped the trap shut. And that was her rude awakening. And she decided there and then, right, well, I'm going to, once I've got out from this drugs charge, I'm going to make sure that nobody else ever has to have that same experience again that I've just had. And I thought, you know, I was just blown away by her saying that. I thought, you know, what right have I got with all of the support and care and love around me that I have to imagine that I should presume to make more trouble for everybody by taking my life? So basically there and then, I was completely devoted to Positively Women, completely devoted to peer support, forever grateful to her and to the original lady on that first call. So Positively Women is just amazing, and all the peer support they gave to me and to so many women, and of course to everybody since then, since they've turned into Positively UK over the years.
Thanks, Alice. I think we've heard echoes in what you've said with so many of the other individuals we've spoken to over this podcast series, and the importance of being held and spoken to as someone who is living the same as you has come out time and time again, and the importance of peer support being vital. The first information you get about your diagnosis, that first conversation, is always exceedingly difficult. And I think what you demonstrated is, no matter where you are, actually that first impulse is so hard to acknowledge or to fight. And that's in a sense where we're looking at today, is that how can we hold individuals with care rather than them being ostracized or shunned, especially in terms of gender and especially about the space for women. And here I'm thinking about the bigger question is, what is it about gender? What is it about women who they need a different type of focus when it comes to discussing and caring for their health?
Well, where to begin? I think that what we've known for a long, long, long time, there's now very clear evidence to show that so much of health in the UK, as well as global health, has been structured around men and men's needs. And clinical trials, for example, have taken place far more with men. So much of what is created in terms of policies and programs around health relates to men. So, for example, whether that comes down to doses of medication, whether that comes down to an assumption that the kinds of things which affect women are just somehow the same as men and don't need to be investigated separately. I think I'm right in saying that more than 50% of medical students in the UK now are female. But traditionally, until maybe 50 years ago, there were very few female doctors in positions of authority. And on top of that, of course, they were mostly white men with well-to-do backgrounds who went into medical profession. So, you know, we have all of those intersectionalities basically around who it was who was shaping policy and was leading programs. We've done some research and looked at the background of the development of global healthcare. And there's a very, very clear track now going back to the origins, for instance, of the London School of Hygiene or Liverpool School of Tropical Health and other institutions like those around the world. which clearly show how a lot of global health was related to empire building and colonialism, and basically keeping the predominantly male workers of the empire free from sickness. And so, you know, there are very clear reasons why it was all very male oriented. But thankfully, we are now increasingly realizing how it wasn't something which was just driven by so-called science. And obviously, we know that the majority of people in the world are female. We know that so often policies are just not fit for purpose when they come to women. For example, we've done research for UN Women on treatment access barriers for women living with HIV. And these are absolutely enormous, and they go back to things like violence against women in the home, violence against women in healthcare settings, childcare, for example. How do you find the funds to get not only yourself on a bus, but also maybe to take your child with you, et cetera, et cetera. But the violence issue in particular is a huge one. Other people have done research, WHO's done research that shows that violence against women increases women's vulnerability to acquiring HIV in the first place by a factor of 1.5. And then research that we've done globally has shown how women, once we're diagnosed with HIV, we're vulnerable either to violence against women starting in our lives, or if we're already experiencing it, increasing. And this is both at home and in healthcare settings. And violence against women it's a parallel pandemic in relation to HIV. It's a comorbidity, if you like. People recognize that malaria and TB are comorbidities in relation to HIV. And that doesn't mean that everybody has them, but that a huge number of people do have them and that they make each other worse. But it's still not recognized that violence against women is also in that same category and so significant. So that really has been an area that I've particularly focused on, the interconnectedness between violence against women and HIV in the overall context of our sexual and reproductive health and rights.
Yeah. And I think that's fundamentally the focus, is like this question of both sexual and reproductive health rights. And that leads me to my next question is, so how does your work work against this? I'm thinking particularly about the establishments of the Stepping Stones program in the early 90s, which was so key as part of my work. I remember reading about it, you know, so it's a really big, important part of the research and a different response to talking about relationships, to talking about communication, and then later on the Salamander Trust.
Before I was diagnosed in 1992, I'd already been working internationally, living and working in East Africa and in Southern Africa and West Africa as well, and a little bit in Asia, in participatory approaches to understanding what was going on in communities. So what I'd been doing was I'd been involved in a movement. In those days, it was called rapid rural appraisal, but then it turned into what's called participatory learning approaches, a network of amazing people, largely from the global south, and also including a fantastic man called Robert Chambers, based at Institute of Development Studies. And they used to have regular meetings down there in Sussex, where he was based, and we would just come away completely bowled over with amazement and incredulity at how much one could learn from people in communities, which sounds ridiculous. But in those days, there was such a strong assumption that people in communities didn't really know anything, and that they had to go and be taught by outsiders who would go and wag their fingers at them, whether they were health workers or agriculturalists or forestry workers or whatever, which was again part of that whole colonial legacy. And what we were learning instead and involved in understanding was how incredibly rich local knowledge is, and local research, and the power of lived experience and the critical importance of recognizing how lived experience is absolutely crucial to developing policies and programs which are effective, as well as being ethical, as well as being sustainable. So my role, which was a tiny one, but I was involved in going to work with NGO staff from international NGOs in different countries in East and Southern and West Africa to support the staff, really to unlearn what they had drummed into them in their nurses training institutes or their agricultural colleges or whatever, where they had been taught the go in with your finger wagging rule and tell people off and tell them what they should be doing. And to say, actually, they know so much, and actually our role should be to go in and understand from them and listen to them and learn from them, and to ask who and why and how and where and when and what else, and really to understand the world from their perspective and try to work with them to support them to explore issues, and so that we can understand better what are the constraints that they're facing, so that any support or advice that we can give is within their own context, and also recognizing the interconnectedness of everything rather than being in silos of, right, this is the health issue, this is the agriculture issue, exactly, et cetera, this is the water issue.
And actually that space to actually have quite an open conversation where everyone is treated as equals.
Absolutely. And that was one of the things which I'd like to hope I contributed a little bit to, because a lot of people had been doing this training, really bringing everybody in a group together in a community. And for the most part, of course, that would mean the men and the elders who were men, the community leaders. And often that meant then that younger people and any women might not be involved in those conversations at all. And so one of the things that I was involved in encouraging these NGO staff to think about was to split themselves up according to age and gender, so that they would be doing different exercises, whether it might be mapping what's going on in the village, or whether it might be seasonal calendars, understanding the linkages, for instance, between the hungry season and poverty in communities or in households, etc. I was encouraging them to do that on the basis of working in separate peer groups based on age and gender, so that you could then actually really get into understanding more clearly what the different perspectives of different community members were, rather than assuming that everybody in the community has the same perspective and the same experience. So what was coming out of that very clearly for me, no matter where I was doing this work, was that women in communities were talking about violence against women.
Yeah.
Long story short, when I was diagnosed with HIV, and I was just so blown away by this incredible support that already these women from Positively Women have given me, I was thinking, okay, well, what can I do? What can I give back? How can I support others out there somehow to move on from these challenges? And since that was really my sort of area that I knew about most, working internationally in rural communities, I thought, okay, well, I'll try to develop a training program which is based on the arts. So using a lot of role play based on Paulo Freire and Augusto Boal were hugely strong influences. And based on this whole concept of working according to peer groups or based on gender and age, and also using other types of the arts, dance, song, drawing things, and also sculpting things at times, in order to support people in their own communities to understand what's going on for them in their own lives, and to say, think of a situation that you or someone like you has found themselves in, and let's create a little skit around that, and what happened, and, you know, was that what you wanted to happen, and what might have been, you know, if it was a negative outcome, what might have been a more positive outcome, and how could that have been created? And then, you know, to change the skit,
yeah,
to think about different approaches. So that by asking these open questions and just by creating the framework for those questions to be explored by community members with highly trained facilitators, making use of their own stories to create their own narratives and analysis.
And coming back to the lived experience, the individual as expert in their own health.
Exactly. Exactly. And then by sharing and comparing, so Stepping Stones is quite a few sessions, and most of them are in these separate peer groups based on gender and age, each with their own facilitator. And then every few sessions, they come together and share and compare what they have been learning about in their own peer groups by doing kind of role plays in front of each other, performing them to one another.
Yeah.
And thereby building trust, not only within each peer group, but also by building bridges of understanding and shared learning across the genders and across the generations. So really over the course of these sessions, really building a sense of common values and principles and understanding and a shared vision for their community.
And actually someone else to have a conversation with. It's very similar to the DramAid model in South Africa, where they started with peer educators. And again, that space to have a conversation with someone who's a bit older than you, who can actually give advice, where you're talking to someone who's more your peer, which is a great first step, rather than having to go in a crisis mode to a healthcare worker or to a parent.
Absolutely.
And actually opening channels of communications and networks of support and networks of care.
Absolutely. I mean, we call it rehearsing for reality, so that already in advance, you've already had the opportunity to think ahead about what situation you might find yourself in and how you feel you could respond most effectively without suddenly finding yourself in that situation in crisis and complete terror or whatever.
Yeah.
In communities, we've so often found distrust between young men, young women, for example, and blame around, oh, you know, it's those lads who just bring HIV into our community, or it's those girls, don't trust them.
Yeah.
You know, they just cheat on you. And instead, supporting them to recognize, actually, you know what, this is something so much bigger than all of us. And that blame and shame don't take us anywhere. They just take us into dark places. And actually, all of us want something much bigger and much more meaningful and much more important to all of us than this. So it's really also developing a sense of a critical understanding. It's critical analysis of separating fact from fiction.
Yeah. And that's the thing I think is most interesting about all of these models or these responses to, like, how do we talk about HIV? How do we start conversations about what feels safe for you or right for you sexually? Is that actually what is happening there is the space for a type of learning, and that actually is applicable to anyone's life across
exactly.
any remnant.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's one of the things that I often find so challenging, is that women and HIV, when they're combined, those two words are combined, it's often very much viewed in a deficit mode. Is that the women or that as a result of the HIV are lesser. And actually, we know that's rubbish. And my question to you is, what is it that unites women living with HIV globally?
Well, one of the things, first of all, I just wanted to say was that with Stepping Stones, we've also found it so important to support everyone to develop their own sense of self-esteem.
Mm.
I mean, again, that's going back to my own experience, for example. With my own diagnosis, how so much of the world out there, media, et cetera, is just so full of very negative perspectives. Before diagnosis, I was already feeling support and compassion for people with HIV. But once I was diagnosed, it was all those negative messages that actually came flooding in. You know, how could this have happened to me? And I failed everybody, et cetera, which was a complete travesty, because it is so not about blame and shame. You know, it's a bug in our bodies. Anybody can get it. And it's not about being HIV either. You know, so often I still hear people saying, I am HIV. And I'm thinking, no, actually, you are such an amazing person, and you just happen to have HIV. And so a lot of Stepping Stones is focused very much around supporting everybody involved to believe in themselves, to focus on what incredible people they are individually for themselves, irrespective of gender, irrespective of age, irrespective of, you know, whatever socially ascribed status they have, that they as an individual are unique and amazing. And then really focusing also on positives all the time and really thinking about positives, because sadly, so often our default assumption about ourselves and about the world is often a very negative one.
Yeah.
And we really often, all of us have to work hard at thinking well about ourselves and thinking well about other people around us. But until we start to think well about ourselves, it's often then difficult to think positively about people around us. And yet that is just such an important thing. So when it comes to women, I mean, one of the things that I'm really pleased to say is that Stepping Stones does have a formal evidence base of managing to reduce violence against women in communities where the program has been done well and adapted well. And that is really great, because that was what it was supposed to do, which is reducing the chances of women acquiring HIV in the first place.
Yeah.
If violence against women has been reduced in the community. We are supporting whole community responses to whatever life is throwing at the community. So often having an HIV diagnosis or experiencing violence against women is a really traumatic event. And so often then individuals are facing post-traumatic stress as a consequence of that. And then on top of that, in many contexts, you also have other traumas or incredible stresses. And obviously there's climate change and there's floods or there's droughts or there's war, civil war or whatever. And what Stepping Stones is doing is really building not only a post-traumatic response, but actually seeking to develop post-traumatic growth.
Mm-hmm.
So that people, once they feel, right, we're coming together, we're feeling more supportive, they can actually then move forward collectively to unite together to overcome the challenges, which they can then see are outside them and not of their own making. And that if they're able to do that, then they are responding from such a more powerful, united position than if they are still blaming and shaming one another, whatever the issue is, whether it's HIV or whether it's gender or themselves. So when it comes to thinking about uniting women living with HIV globally, again, the message is we're stronger together, and so much stronger together than any of us really realize. And this was again one of the fabulous things about Positively Women, that it was bringing these amazing women together through the, you know, the incredible women who you talked with earlier, women like Kate and Caroline and the others whom they worked with, and then out of that growing ICW, and that growth, that amazing growth of ICW around the world has just been,
it's extraordinary.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. Women living with HIV become in all kinds of shapes and sizes. And I think that's something which has been so special for me over the years. I've met such incredible women around and had the huge privilege to work with such amazing women doing phenomenal things with nothing or next to nothing, mostly nothing.
And I think what you described is exactly that, is that actually from this very small little gathering, a weekly gathering that has just grown into, it's an organization, it's an ethos that has influenced so many places and so many people around the world. And it is an extraordinary organization for that, and the way it's held, and the impact of this gathering of women. I think we will never really understand the true, we'll never be able to calculate the real impact. But in a way, this is what we're trying to do with this project, is to really take a moment and to think and to acknowledge where we've come from And this project is specifically looking at the importance of the archive and acknowledging the past to think about how we might move forward. So we ask everyone who comes on the podcast the following question: what are you bringing from your past into your future?
Such an interesting one. Well, basically, right now, what I'm bringing from my past into my future is the ongoing search for core funding for women's rights organizations, which is just unbelievably, chronically, shockingly, scandalously atrocious.
Yeah.
There's a paper from a report on AWID's website, which is several years old now. I think it might be even 2014 or something, which talks about exactly that. And it's something, it's called something like 20 years of scandalously limited funding for women's rights organizations. And it has a chart on that website, which is, again, deeply distressing, because it compares the funding for a group of women's rights organizations around the world, and it compares it to some major international organizations which are all familiar to household names. And it's just shocking, so shocking. Somebody said the other day in a paper for Christian Aid, somebody said, whoever said that the evidence base is actually what changes policies and programs? I think it was Ben Phillips said that. And that echoes what Albert Einstein said. If you want to fix things, you can't just go on using the same tools you've used so far. You've got to use new and different tools. You've got to think differently. And this is where lived experience comes in, because hardly anybody ever listens to lived experience, because they say, oh, that's anecdotal, or where's your evidence? And this is what is just so unbelievably frustrating, that there are so many incredible women doing phenomenal things around the world, and the bureaucracy which they have to go through to create an organization, to be formally registered, to have a minimum amount of income in order to be able to apply to an organization, to have 3 years of audited accounts. The list goes on.
Yeah.
The hoops that they have to jump through in order even to begin to get a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of funding is just appalling. And then on top of that, that funding that they do get, it's for a project. Donors aren't interested in core costs, because core costs are boring.
Never. And they don't produce any shiny photos.
Exactly. And yet core costs, it's just completely fundamental to any organization's existence to have background core costs.
Yeah.
And we are all struggling so much. And yet the phenomenal work which women do. And this is really what I also want to bring forward into my future, is just going on believing in women because of the amazing things that women do. Always, always, always to support not just themselves, but to support all of their communities. And you know what? They also put all their communities first every time, and often don't look after themselves.
Yeah.
And that's what I just, you know, I go on sort of feeling just so privileged, so in awe of all the women that I've met and have had that amazing opportunity to connect with and work with over the years around the world.
Alice, thank you so much for an extraordinary conversation. It has been such an honor to have you on the program, and thank you.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Kat, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more, please like and subscribe to this podcast and share it with your friends. If you are affected by anything shared in the podcast, please see the Positively UK website for a list of their services and other support organisations. I've been Kat Lowe. These podcasts have been edited by Chuck Blue Lowry, coordinated with Joy and Solidarity by Mariam Shahara-Dean and Chriselle Ducuzin, music by Jessica Roach.